this week's program, David Patrick Stearns profiles the Ecuadorian-born, Philadelphia-based composer Diego Lizarraga. Eric Brannan considers a Philadelphia public art exhibition viewable only through the screens of smartphones. Susan Lewis takes a look at the life and music of the great jazz vocalist Ella Fitzgerald. And we speak with Fiac MacAneill, artistic director of the Abbey Theatre, the National Theatre of Ireland. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The Philadelphia Orchestra's recent Inca Trails concert at the Kimmel Center promised some stunning visuals of the Andes and exotic sounds from composers from along the Inca Trail that connected what is now Ecuador, Bolivia, Peru, and parts of Argentina. Not so expected was the discovery of a locally based composer, Diego Lizarraga, who is 55 and has been teaching in Wynwood near Philadelphia for the past decade. His operas, oratorios, and concertos have been performed from his native Ecuador to Tokyo to Minneapolis. So, why hadn't we heard of him? The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns discovered that it's not because his music is quiet.
All composers have their own singular journey to artistic maturity, but Diego Lizarraga's took side roads from the most remote villages of Ecuador to the most rarefied circles of Paris. In one way or another, his music reflects it all.
My idea was, can I compose a piece of music where there's a drumming from beginning to end? If you go to a folk festival in Ecuador, you go to the solstice festivities high up in the Andes, you hear drumming, not for 1 minute, not for 10 minutes, for 3 days. So I said, why not compose a piece on that vein? But instead of just one drum and one flute, you use a symphony orchestra.
The result was Responsorio, the piece that was introduced by the Philadelphia Orchestra following successes in Baltimore and Tanglewood, where Peruvian conductor Miguel Harth Bedoya has performed his Inca Trails concerts. But when formulating the program years back, the conductor wasn't exactly struck with the idea that some Lizarraga might be rather nice to hear. He had to hunt around before discovering him and his music.
I started building a network of, I suppose, collaborators or future collaborators, composers, performers, literally through the internet, colleagues of mine, searching by countries, by musical periods. So doing my own research, and composers of Ecuador, various ones, and the name of Diego Lizarraga came up, and I just wrote him an email, and he happily replied.
But not from Ecuador. He lives in suburban Philadelphia with his wife and children and teaches at Friends Central School in Wynwood. And as much as Lizarraga enjoys going to concerts in Philadelphia, he hasn't been in touch with Network for New Music or Orchestra 2001, two groups that might be interested in performing him. Music is not his primary reason for being here.
My plan was to stay in Ecuador. Well, I was busy there. But for the health of my daughter with special needs, and she couldn't be taken care of properly in Ecuador, so moved to here.
Lizarraga did enter a Christmas carol contest in Minneapolis a few years ago and won. That led to a relationship with the famous Minnesota choral conductor Philip Brunel and, increasingly, a place among the Latin American composers being embraced by a larger world. The Argentinian Osvaldo Golioff is one of America's most sought-after composers. Younger ones, such as Gabriela Lena Frank, are also doing quite well. Two common characteristics that Harth Bedoya hears in Latin Americans is their ability to immerse themselves so completely into any given commission that they're constantly reinventing their methods of composition and doing so in ways that has a visceral effect on audiences.
The intellect doesn't interfere in presenting the music. In the presentation of the piece, I just find that the music is as direct as it can be.
That visceral effect appears to arise from a strong sense of cultural identity. Diego Luzuriaga spent his first 27 years getting music from sources untouched by modernity. In the remote southern Ecuadorian province where he grew up, he spoke the archaic Spanish of early colonialists. But that wasn't nearly as remote as the villages he visited with his musician buddies, armed with a reel-to-reel tape recorder to make field recordings of everything they heard. But also having heard symphony orchestras on the radio, Luzuriaga realized he needed more training than Ecuador could then provide. Thanks to some scholarships, he's lived in London, Brazil, and New York, where he studied at Columbia University and the Manhattan School of Music. More importantly, he went to L'École Normale in Paris, where he worked at the IRCOM Electronic Music Studio and was inspired by cutting-edge composers, as illustrated in this flute work titled Yerarvi.
I did the whole trip around the world. I went to France. I studied with the composers, and I was influenced by spectral music, Tristan Murail, Gérard Griset, which was à la mode in those years.
This was the kind of music he was hearing.
But then, little by little, I came back to my own traditions. But the music that I kept in my mind from those years. And then I think, I hope I have made a good round trip.
Yet traditions lurk behind traditions, ones that Luzuriaga can only guess at, but are reflected in responsorio.
Some people told me that some of those melodies sound Japanese. And I said, oh, I thought I was composing Ecuadorian music. If you go to the countryside in Ecuador, for example, you can hear pentatonic tunes that I bet they have been in the air for 400 or 500 years. There's this theory that 20,000 years ago, the Americas were populated by peoples from Asia, right? Yeah, there must be some connection. Because the melodies tend to be, in general, pentatonic.
However fascinating this confluence, Luzuriaga seems oddly lackadaisical about sharing it with the rest of the world.
I'm not that in a hurry, I suppose, to push my work, even though my friends and families say that I should. I have a web page newly redesigned by my 14-year-old son. I enjoy my basement. I compose sometimes for the pleasure of composing, but mostly because I have commissions, and that makes me happy.
One wonders what other riches might exist in those field tapes he made years ago, especially now that the world has a greater appreciation of Latin American cultures.
And you still have those tapes?
Somewhere. I don't know. At some point I worked for an institution there, and we did plenty of recordings there, and then I suppose they kept all those tapes. But the most important recording place is up here, right? The memory. The most important archive, should I say.
Perhaps only a fellow Latin American, namely conductor Harth Bedoya, could explain why Luzuriaga is happy to have music live in his head rather than preserved in more permanent ways.
For us, music is not music that we learn in conservatories or in music school. Music is a lot more part of daily life in Latin America. People make music, they sing, they dance. When the Europeans arrive in the Americas and they heard music, they heard a lot of music, and all of this is recorded in testimonials, in letters, in diaries, everybody was making music. That concept of I'm going to hear music didn't exist for a long time. Music was part of your life, whether it was for work, for harvesting, for celebration. And a lot of that is still part in our culture. So there are a lot of musicians and composers like Diego Luzuriaga that are around, and some of them still don't write to their music.
It's a bit hard to imagine music that one lives rather than learns. But for Luzuriaga, what he lived is maybe his greatest asset.
In Ecuador, actually, it's a common place for artists to complain that the country doesn't do anything for me. I need money. I need a scholarship. I need free tuition. And I bet that's true, but the memories of my childhood the melodies I heard up there in the Andes, those things were provided by my culture, by my country. And that's not a small gift. And I thank my country for that, my culture, for providing me with those things. And I'm using them all the time.
So let's hear it more now.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Sitting atop the steps of the Philadelphia Museum of Art is a massive new sculpture. However, this, as well as many other new public artworks dotted around the city, are easy to miss if you don't know where or especially how to look for them. Now WRTI's Eric Brown considers a new project by two groups working to create virtual works of art that exist in real places.
Right now, a giant squid is hovering above the Schuylkill at the Fairmount Waterworks. An alien with a Juan Miró painting for skin is standing frozen at the top of the steps at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Though invisible to the naked eye, these sculptures do exist, but only in a sort of new technology ether, and only accessible by a smartphone.
We place 3D computer models, sculptures, at site-specific locations.
Chris Manzione is the founder and director of the Virtual Public Art Project.
And users can go to these locations with their smartphone and view the models in the round.
Teaming up with Breadboard, an art and technology advocate working out of the University City Science Center, the groups have placed 34 virtual sculptures by 23 artists in various locations around the city. The technology being used to make these works visible is called augmented reality. Though it may not sound familiar, Manzione says it's been used on television for years.
If you're watching a football game and there's digital lines that go across the field and say like what down it is or how many more yards they have to go, that's augmented reality. So it's a live view through a camera with digital information on top of it.
Meaning that contextual information ranging from text to three-dimensional graphics like those in the Virtual Public Art Project can be superimposed over a live image that, in this case, is produced and viewed on a smartphone, specifically certain Apple iPhones or devices running Google's Android operating system. The applications of this technology are broad, ranging from video games that use a player's location as its setting to sightseeing guides that display information relevant to where the viewer's standing. Manzione, who is also a sculptor of real objects, says that augmented reality enables him to do things as an artist not possible in the real world.
Logistically, I can have shows all around the world. I can make sculptures that are 1,000 feet tall. I can make them float. They can have animated texture on them. So, like, building things beyond physics.
Using GPS, artists are able to put virtual objects in places they've personally never even been. Breadboard director Dan Schimmel says that this gives artists the chance to create site-specific works which would otherwise be off-limits.
Some of the most interesting projects that artists are doing are using augmented reality to comment on physical spaces and physical realities. So they've put some augmented reality sculptures around very politically charged locations, say the border between Mexico and the U.S., Chernobyl. Somebody could put something over Guantanamo, which is a restricted area. So it gives artists a lot of potential if their art is commenting on social issues or events that happen around the world.
Though there are no politically charged works in the current Virtual Public Art Project show, the sculptures were placed in relevant locations.
Some of the works are more site-specific and interact with the space. For instance, we have one of those eight-ball cubes that is next to Rodin's Thinker.
The site-specific nature of augmented reality is part of the appeal for Chris Manzione.
Otherwise, you know, you can email anything. I could email you that sculpture. That's easy. But requiring someone to walk out or go into the middle of Philadelphia and, like, move around.
However, like any technology in its infancy, augmented reality is not without its problems. The processing power of smartphones has only recently developed enough to achieve anything close to the desired effect of the Virtual Public Art Project. But the technology can still be limiting.
conceptually, there's much more interesting things that can be done or that will be able to be done. Right now, we're limited to model size and how complex that model is, and also everything's fairly static.
There are also questions about whether or not this public art project can truly be considered public.
Obviously, there's a big digital divide, and there's a lot of people who don't have access to the technology, so they can't even see the works.
Chris Manzione agrees, but is optimistic.
Right now, yeah, it excludes a very large portion of the public. And, you know, it is the virtual public art project, and it operates within a small group of people who have the devices to go see it. But, you know, I think same as the internet, it's going to be something that's on every phone, like a camera or a touchscreen. I think it'll be something very easily accessed, if not thrown in front of your face.
However, today it is still a frontier medium, which can be both rewarding and challenging.
I think it's exciting. I think a lot of things are being figured out, and it's even at times hard to be considered in an art context sometimes. It's sort of dismissed as not a fine art or not art at all. It's just this like techie thing that we're like goofing around with, but I don't feel that way.
Though the validity of computer-generated sculpture as art is still up for debate, it's important to remember that when technological advances like photography and motion pictures were first presented as art, they were greeted at best with skepticism and, at worst, with disdain. Despite its technical limitations and relative exclusivity, the implications of the virtual public art project are impressive. Art that can be as large and complex as an artist's mind allows, rather than what they can afford or are permitted by the physical limitations of our world.
WRTI's Eric Brannan. For information on how to view the sculptures in the Virtual Public Art Project, follow the link at WRTI.org. The late great jazz singer Ella Fitzgerald, dubbed the First Lady of Song, continues to be a musical icon, a pillar in the history of jazz. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at her life, her music, and her legacy.
The young woman who had become the most popular jazz singer of her generation didn't set out to become a singer. At least, not until a November evening in 1934, when fate placed her center stage at Harlem's Apollo Theater on amateur night. Born in Virginia in 1917, Ella Jane Fitzgerald grew up in Yonkers, New York until her mother's death in 1932, when Ella moved to Harlem to live with her aunt. Money was scarce, and Ella reportedly danced in the streets for tips. But it was to be singing, not dancing, that would make her famous, as WRTI jazz host Bob Perkins, who has been spinning R&B and jazz records for over 40 years, describes.
She entered an amateur contest as a dancer. She chickened out at the last minute on the dancing because she was very nervous and said, "No, I want to sing." So, I mean, if you're too nervous to dance, then you're going to choose singing? I think it might be the other way around, you know what I mean? Because fear certainly shows up in your voice when you try to sing or speak. And she won the contest.
Winning amateur night launched her career. Bandleader and drummer Chick Webb took her under his wing and hired her to sing with his band. In 1938, Ella's rendition of A Tisket, A Tasket became a hit.
A tisket, a tasket, a brown and yellow basket. I send a letter to my mummy on the way I dropped it.
When Chick Webb died the next year, Ella took over the band. They played together three more years. Meanwhile, Ella's solo career took off. While there were few women instrumentalists in the mid-20th century jazz world, Ella could rival any solo instrument in the band. She had an ability, says Perkins, to adapt to any style of music and create any mood, and she was a master at improvisation.
I loved her great rubber band voice, as I call it. She could stretch it and pull it and sing just about anything. Magnificent ballad singer, could handle anything up-tempo, medium-tempo, you name it. And she was known as one of the great scatters of all time.
Scat singing, lyrical vocalizing with nonsense syllables and improvising like a trumpet or saxophone soloist, was an outgrowth of bebop, pioneered by people like Dizzy Gillespie. Contemporary jazz and soul singer Patti Austin says that in those days, singers were trying to sound like instruments.
Scatting is, in fact, emulating, simulating what a jazz musician would play on a solo. So when you listen to people like Sinatra and Ella and Sarah and Nat King Cole, all of those people were not trying to sound like each other. They were trying to sound like Dizzy and Miles and Charlie Parker and Thelonious Monk, and it was all about sounding like an instrument.
Bob Perkins thinks that in Ella's case, the desire to imitate may have gone both ways.
A lot of people who play horn might have been affected by Ella. They wish they could play the horn as well as Ella could sing and approximate a horn.
Ella's genius at improvisation extended not only to scat singing nonsense syllables, but to making up new words for songs on the spot, without missing a beat.
Was it 56 or 58 in Germany, when she was singing Mack the Knife and forgot the words, and halfway through just sort of ad-libbed the rest of the stuff. And it came out, and it's a legendary piece of music.
Ella's virtuosity extended beyond any one form of music. She sang with jazz greats like Dizzy Gillespie, Louis Armstrong, Count Basie, and Duke Ellington, but also reached across musical genres to sing pop standards. In the 40s, she sang Gershwin, and in the 50s, she began a series of songbook recordings dedicated to other major American composers like Cole Porter and Irving Berlin. In these recordings, Ella created jazz-inflected arrangements of pop standards, thereby introducing a whole new audience to the idea of jazz.
Blue skies smiling at me, nothing but blue skies do I see.
Patty Austin says the popularity of the songbooks dovetailed with a significant era in American history and culture.
Music is always a reflection of the culture and the society and the generation. The generation that made that music, that created the Great American Songbook, was in the Depression, it was in the Second World War, and so the music lives on.
Ella Fitzgerald's music does live on in over 200 albums and over 40 million records sold. She won 13 Grammy Awards and performed on television variety shows and live on stages all over the world, from Carnegie Hall to Berlin. Offstage and away from microphones and cameras, Ella led a simple life. She was married briefly and had one child. During her later years, she was plagued by vision and other health problems, and her friends and family guarded her privacy. In 1993, 3 years before she died at the age of 79, she created the Ella Fitzgerald Charitable Foundation to promote education and love of music for disadvantaged children, to provide health and medical care to needy families, and to fund medical research. During her lifetime, Ella received countless honors, including the National Medal of Arts, the Kennedy Center Honors, France's Commander of Arts and Letters Award, as well as many academic honorary degrees. Since her death, her image has even graced a U.S. postage stamp. Ella's music continues to inspire recordings and tributes. Patty Austin, whose album For Ella was released in 2002, says she's not trying to mimic the great singer as much as pay tribute to her.
Sweet and pure, that's for sure. And you always know when you're hearing Ella sing.
I always tell people it's like going through Ella's closet and trying on her clothes and taking them to a great tailor and saying, okay, I want to wear this dress. Take it in the waist, let it out in the hips, whatever.
You're staying true to her style, but putting your own spin on it?
Very much so. There are a couple of numbers that I like to do Ella style. By that I mean certainly not in her voice, because that's the first and the last and the only, but using her notes. So there are two performances that are like that, but everything else is straight from the heart.
Straight from the heart and in the moment would certainly seem to be Ella's style. Whether expressively rendering melodies, scat singing, or making up new lyrics on the spot, whether performing all over the world, or working to ensure that music would enrich the lives of children, the First Lady of Song touched the hearts of generations and left a legacy that continues to inspire anyone who loves a good song.
WRTI's Susan Lewis.
We hope to like her!
The Irish relationship with the English language is as complicated as that of the Irish people with their former imperial masters. Besides being one of the youngest nation-states in the West, Ireland is also where English has the shortest history as the de facto native language. Prior to the potato blight of 1845 to 1852 that caused millions to die of starvation or flee Ireland, the main language of the Irish people was Gaeilge, Gaelic, The Irish language are today simply Irish, which is closer to the Romance languages like Spanish and Italian than those of Germanic origin like English and Dutch. British government policy in Ireland from the 17th century onwards made it economically and socially beneficial to speak English, and after the Great Hunger, not famine, Ireland was a net exporter of food during the 1840s and 50s, the Irish language went into serious decline, to be eventually superseded by English. But not English as spoken in England. The structure of the Irish language and the Irish accent became integral to that version of English spoken by the Irish people, and it continues to evolve today as a distinct dialect. This Anglo-Irish dialect is much in evidence in the work of writers from W.B. Yeats to James Joyce to Oscar Wilde, and more recently Frank McCourt and Roddy Doyle. Yet it is in theatrical literature that English, as spoken in Ireland, has had its biggest stage. So when I met with Fiach MacAneill, the artistic director of the Abbey Theatre, Ireland's national theatre, I first asked him to describe this special relationship between the Irish people and the English language.
We're a community that depended much on the oral tradition, okay? And that oral tradition is centuries old. The idea of telling a story, transmitting that story to the next generation, whether it's a song, a poem. It's also important that the poet was a very, very important part of every ancient Irish tribe and Irish community. A poet would celebrate a great success by a chieftain or a great travesty or a great disaster and would write a poem about that. So poetry, literature, writing is really an elemental part of what we are as a community. Without that, there is no such thing as an Irish psyche, an Irish mind, or indeed an Irish community. And that's developed and developed. And I think what happened in the earlier part of the 20th century was that all these writers came together and felt, you know what, our lives and our traditions aren't seen on our stages. So that's why W.B. Yeats and Gregory and Synge came together and said, you know, it's our job to make sure that our citizens see what we're about on our stages and not some other work perhaps from England or Europe that actually had no regard for that. And that's what our bottom line is. All our writers, whether it's Marco Rowe or whether it's W.B. Yeats, write about the here and now and communicate that to their citizens, and it's become very much a part of that. Now, the second reason why perhaps we're so successful, we've kind of colonised the English language, you know. For many, many years, Irish was our language and English was forced on us, but what we did and what James Joyce did and what Synge did was, hang on a minute, yeah, that's a language, but we're going to colonise that and we're going to use it in our way and use the musicality of the Irish language, put it into the English, and ba-boom, that's what we have. And I think those are some of the reasons why we're quite successful.
The subject matter of most new work that appears at the Abbey generally looks at Ireland or the Irish condition. Is that a rule or is it a tradition or is it just a coincidence?
Well, no, I mean, we're a national theatre, okay, so we're not like any other theatre. So our job is to reflect and engage Irish society. That's what I have to wake up every morning thinking, okay, so the promise I make to the citizen or the visitor is if they come to the Abbey for a whole year, they should get a sense of what people are talking about. They should get a sense of what the world is about. They should get a sense of, you know, what the big issues of the day is. So I sit down and when I program, I look both at a classical work like Shakespeare or our own Irish repertoire and then try and mix that with some of the Irish work. So we're dependent. I mean, without sounding in any way too esoteric, our artists are our prophets, right? And a lot of our artists write about something that perhaps we haven't even kind of considered yet, you know. When you look at the great play that Brian Freer wrote, Philadelphia, Here I Come, which was the first time that a writer ever used two actors for one part, Gar Private and Gar Public. The idea of the split imagination, the inner voice, the outer voice, and how that works. So we actually do depend on our artists and our writers to kind of tell us what's happening, tell us how we feel, how anxious we are. And so if you mix that with the repertoire work, where you can actually be directly political, if we say with a Shakespeare or an O'Casey, then the job of the National Theatre, the Abbey Theatre, is to present all that in one seamless programme and, of course, to highly entertain people as well. I mean, you know, it is a bit of fun to come and see a lot of our shows as well.
Abbey Theatre of Ireland Artistic Director, Fiach MacAneill. And that's our programme for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milnoff. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.